The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, I'm Doris Hyde for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Vision News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various websites with non-time-sensitive content. First up, from Assistive Technology for the Blind, I see a post from February 19th of this year, last year, from Stacy Patnode Bassett, B-A-S-S-E-T-T. Friends, for some of you, this post will be uncomfortable to read. Believe me, I understand. It's uncomfortable for me to write. But I'm going to anyway. I was born blind, not visually impaired, with some amount of usable vision, but in the even smaller minority. I am totally blind without even light perception. And I grew up being told that was okay, I was okay, that I was confident and capable and I could do anything I wanted. I grew up climbing trees, riding my bike around my town, riding horses, running at top speed down a sun-drenched Florida beach. I grew up free. I was loved. I was a little spoiled. I was given tools and taught how to live an independent life. And yet, I was bullied in school because I'm blind. Not to the degree of many others, but it happened. It's something I've never talked about. Eighth grade math class was the worst. There was a group of kids that sat between me and the teacher's desk, and every time I walked by them, they would say things like, "Watch out for that tree! Watch out for the mud puddle!" And they'd laugh, and no one ever noticed. In high school, a male classmate told me that it would be easy to rape a blind and deaf woman because she wouldn't be able to identify her attacker. Teachers and classmates constantly asked me if I could guess who they were. Did I recognize a voice? How many fingers were they holding up? People would come up behind me and put their hands over my eyes and said, "Guess who?" And I played along. Because I'm blind, the state paid for college and grad school and the incredibly expensive assistive technology I needed in order to keep up with assignments and to participate in class. In exchange, I was required to go to a state school and get a degree in specific fields so I would be employable. And even though I was supposed to feel grateful, thankful for the opportunities I was given, I hated college and grad school because I ultimately ended up with a master's degree in a field that wasn't a good fit for me. But I was employable. From the time I turned 18 until I got my first job at 28, I received a small check monthly from the government that made it possible for me to pay rent and bills and to live away from home. Unlike many young adults, I never even had a part-time job because employers weren't interested in providing workplace accommodations, and my vocational rehabilitation counselor wouldn't pay for assistive technology for just because part-time young person job. During grad school, I interviewed for a volunteer position at a crisis hotline. I was told I couldn't work there because I was blind. A couple years later, the same person who'd interviewed me called me to let me know she'd stumbled across my resume and she thought I'd be a perfect fit for the crisis hotline. Could I start training? Oh, I had to miss the first class? No problem. She felt confident that based on my experience at a crisis hotline at OU, that I could easily catch up. But wait. I was the blind woman she wouldn't consider 2 years ago? Well, I mean, you probably wouldn't be a good fit after all. We've moved to a building with stairs. When applying for jobs after grad school, the discrimination and rejections were constant. I couldn't even get hired in an entry-level position where the starting salary was $22,000 because I was blind and most of those starter mental health jobs required a valid driver's license. When I was working, I didn't have to just keep track of the minutiae of my job. I had to plan transportation every day. What I'd do if my ride was late, or if it didn't show up at all. I had to wait for rides in all weather, from hot summer days to rain and wind and snow. Sometimes my ride wouldn't get me home for an hour or more after work. Not only did I have to master all aspects of my job, but I had to learn the layout of my office and how to navigate the environment around my workplace if I ever wanted to leave it during the day. I had to memorize voices of coworkers, clients, and others around the office. I had to constantly learn new technology shortcuts and how to navigate only somewhat accessible databases and processes. If something took a sighted coworker 2 clicks to accomplish, it was likely to take me 5 or 6 keyboard commands. It was exhausting. And as a blind employee, I always had to make sure I was presenting myself well, that my clothes always looked professional and appropriate, because I'd be judged more harshly than my sighted counterparts. If I dripped coffee on myself or dropped guacamole on my shirt because the peppers in my burrito bowl were in long strips and I didn't realize it until one of them was on my fork dripping on me, it would reflect negatively on the image I needed to project of a competent, professional, blind person. Throughout my life, I've experienced discrimination, ignorance, microaggressions, and ableist comments. Strangers ask me incredibly invasive questions about the reason for my blindness. They ask me how I use the bathroom, how I know when I'm on my period, about my romantic relationships. They ask people I'm with at restaurants what she'd like to eat. When I'm shopping, people offer commentary about my body. They talk about my hips, the size of my butt. Once at a clothing boutique in downtown San Rafael, I was looking for something fun to wear to a wedding. The owner told me she had nothing in her store that would fit my girls. I was a healthy, athletic, short and curvy size 10 back then, and my girls were barely large enough for a C-cup era. I've had to advocate for myself in school, for employment, for access with my guide dog, to participate in social activities. In more recent years, I've had to advocate for myself just to go to a restaurant or business with my dog. I have to fill out inaccessible forms every time I fly, including a trip to the vet for a current health certificate. And then I have to wait for my request to bring my dog to be approved. Every time I take a taxi or an Uber, I wonder if the driver will take me. Last summer, I stood by as multiple taxi drivers got into a screaming car roof-pounding F-bomb-slinging fight over a driver's refusal to allow my guide dog in his car. All the time now, I wonder, am I safe? And friends, when it comes right down to it, I am lucky. Yeah, I'm blind, but I have ridiculous amounts of support and privilege. I'm a white, heterosexual woman who at the height of my glory days was passably pretty. I had a solidly middle-class upbringing, and I attended a school that mostly worked with me, not against me. I navigate life with a disability, but I don't have to manage the multi-intersectionality that so many of my peers have to. And friends, right now I'm scared. So effing scared. My worries no longer start with if, but when. When will Ohio, a red state, join the 17 others who want to get rid of Section 504? When will businesses no longer be required to allow me access with my guide dog? When will I lose my ability to access websites and convenience apps because people with disabilities are no longer a priority? When will I lose my autonomy? When you laugh along with those who mock a blind government employee, you're mocking and laughing at me. When you casually reference the parasite class, you're talking about me. Your daughter, your sister, your niece, your cousin, your friend, words have power. Words hurt. And today, I hurt. I'm heart sick and soul sick. And the very thought of stepping out into a world so filled with bigotry and hatred feels impossible. So this afternoon, I'll blast tub thumping and I'll cry in the shower. I'll let my beloved husband hold me tight, and I'll read a book where love wins. Tomorrow, I'll get up again and keep marching, but my heart is too broken to fight just for today. This one was posted in 2024, but I'm not aware that anything has improved. To blind friends and followers, Amy Billman, B-I-L-L-M-A-N, says, if you have value both your time and money, you may want to avoid using Amazon gift cards until the company chooses not to actively and intentionally discriminate against the blind and visually impaired. I was given a $60 gift card, which I stupidly tried to redeem. When I did this, I was met with a request to type the characters I see in the image with no alternative. Companies are supposed to provide some sort of accessible alternative for solving these things. I decided to get sighted assistance to read the characters in the image, which I did, but was still unable to apply it to my balance because even though I didn't redeem it, Amazon's crack systems assumed that it was just by the act of clicking on the URL to apply the money to your wallet. I insanely thought that customer service for people with disabilities would be more helpful than the other customer service department, but alas, after 45 minutes, the only thing I got was confirmation of what was wrong and an escalation to a gift card customer service area where no one can apparently write in intelligible English. I was told to provide an image of both the card and my purchase receipt, and that if they did not have those exact items proving I bought the card, I would not be credited. Meanwhile, I did not purchase it, and so all I could do was forward the original email I was sent when the digital card was issued. While I'm hopeful, I'm not holding my breath that the right thing will be done. Amazon needs to hire too many reps from outside this country who cannot communicate well in writing, and who are just following a decision tree. I think the most disgusting thing, however, was when the gentleman from the Disability Customer Service Department informed me that he would take my feedback about the CAPTCHA problem to the appropriate team as a feature request. Accessibility isn't a feature, idiots. I feel bad for the poor folks with disabilities who are hired to work for Amazon on one of the teams making UX changes because they are being sold a bill of lies. You aren't doing good for customers like you think. They're just clearly hiring you as token disabled employees. I know this is not unique just to Amazon. It's a problem with Apple, Google, Salesforce, Microsoft, etc. Basically, all big tech companies are more concerned with the bright red and shiny and what that does for their public image than creating a truly accessible experience for everyone. But the fact that these companies are touted for having accessibility at their forefront is just gross because it is a blatant lie, which we all need to not spread. I know that nothing will be done about this because we have no blindness organizations truly committed to advocacy. Their advocacy efforts are agenda-based. If it won't give them the attention to take a company to task, it will not happen. And even if it does, Company X will just do just enough to give the appearance of making things better. We have agenda-based advocacy and agenda-based accessibility efforts. As these companies go more toward a concentration on implementing AI everywhere, I don't see things improving because accessibility is becoming more of an afterthought. In Amazon's case, there have been several complaints around inaccessible CAPTCHAs and no change. We all shop there out of convenience, but for how long? I wonder if we will ever reach a point where the blind and visually impaired community is locked out because of Amazon's intentional lack of commitment to make the experience both usable and accessible for everyone. Published March 3rd, 2026 on the-new-review.kglmeridian.com. The Volume 4, Issue 1, guest author, Bradley M. Blair, Master of Education. Braille Access and Its Discontents. Editor's note. In this guest editorial, the author discusses the various ways that the education system and the vocational rehabilitation system often attempt to devalue the necessity of Braille-based access to instruction and information for people who are blind. The author discusses and refutes two myths about Braille access, examines two barriers commonplace to Braille access for adventitiously blind adults, on the vocational rehabilitation system, and suggests two solutions that could alleviate the problem if taken together. He takes a bold stand on the effectiveness of Braille and the essential role it plays in the lives of people who are blind or visually impaired. He also identifies factors through which the vocational rehabilitation system biases counselors against the provision of Braille instruction. Try this hypothetical thought experiment with me. A public policy advocate makes an argument that goes like this. Based on trends in reading scores in the United States, the functional literacy rate among adults and graduating high school students is not where it should be, and has not been for decades. In addition, due to the increased availability of text-to-speech output on e-readers, computers, and smartphones, and given the advent of services like Audible.com, and the prevalence of people preferring to listen to audiobooks while doing other tasks or during their commute, people are listening to things rather than visually reading them now more than ever. Therefore, we should pivot away from teaching reading by sight and encourage the use of vision for other tasks. After all, in the domain of writing, we have largely discarded penmanship and cursive writing, and soon we will have perfected speech-to-text dictation technology so that dictating materials will become the norm. So this proposed shift in how we read parallels with how we write. Additionally, there is a teacher shortage in the United States, with new K-12 teachers remaining in the field an average of just 3 years. This shortage of teachers generally, and reading specialists in particular, is well documented as a chronic and ubiquitous phenomenon. So education needs to pivot from teaching reading by sight, both because there are fewer teachers trained to teach those skills and because other audio-based technology is more efficient for people's learning and information processing. This new reframing of the literacy paradigm will solve the functional illiteracy problem far better than time and dollars spent on visual reading instruction. Rather than arguing about phonics instruction versus whole language processing, for example, we need to teach young people dynamic listening comprehension skills to build their ability to listen to artificially generated speech at various speeds and in multimodal, multi-contextual environments. End of the hypothetical thought experiment. In this thought experiment, I tried to use educational-sounding jargon and literacy concepts to make it sound realistic. I could have even used citations from academic literature to try and give my argument an appearance of legitimacy. The scary thing is that these rhetorical tricks could lead some unwary person somewhere to think the above argument has merit. It does not. It is patently absurd, and so far as I know, no one in educational policy circles is making it. They would be laughed out of the room were they to try. So, why are so many people accepting the subordination of Braille to other things, such as audio materials, almost without protest, when the topic shifts from accessing information using print to accessing information using Braille? My short answer is that many in our own field have fallen victim to misperceptions about Braille. In this brief perspective piece, I first discussed two commonplace misperceptions: the idea that Braille is on the decline, and the idea that Braille is somehow less efficient than other things for instruction and information access. I next discussed two lasting access barriers to Braille instruction faced by adults trying to learn Braille outside of K-12 education. The barriers raised by an inadequate vocational rehabilitation system on the one hand, and the inadequate numbers of qualified Braille instructors on the other hand. Although my focus will be more on the world of adult learners, children's Braille literacy education often suffers equivalent difficulties due to problems that are not entirely different, despite the legislation meant to ensure their access to a free, appropriate public education. I close this editorial by suggesting two solutions that are grounded in the truth of real access barriers rather than in misconceptions about Braille itself. Deconstructing Braille myths. Myth number one, Braille is on the decline. How often have we heard it said that the number of people reading Braille has declined sharply over the past years, and or that only about 10% of blind people read Braille? These claims are echoed both in the education world and within the blind community itself. In the case of the former, claims like these often serve as a justification, implicit or otherwise, for de-emphasizing Braille in one way or another. In the case of the blind community, these claims are often trumpeted as a rallying cry to fight all the harder for Braille education and Braille access. The infamous 10% statistic, however, is dubious at best and wholly unreliable at worst. Sheffield et al., 2022, demonstrates this in a thorough literature review where the authors traced down both the origins and the unreliability of the 10% statistic that our field has both lived with and perpetuated for so long. Briefly put, the 10% figure is based on a couple of original sources that are decades old. One, Berkowitz et al., 1979, is a small study of National Library Service for the Blind and Print Disabled, NLS, reading patrons' material preferences when ordering books. If there is one thing we are taught in statistics never to do, it is to generalize our conclusions from a small or locally based sample. As for the other source, Sheffield et al. 2022 found that authors frequently tried to extrapolate how many child Braille readers there might be from APH Federal Quota Fund census data. The authors explain that there are several problems with doing this. First, the APH has changed how it classifies readers over the years, so the categories of who belongs where has shifted. Second, the federal quota data only capture reading media being used. They have nothing to say about how the student is using it. Also, not every Braille reading child may be captured by the report because it only provides numbers of eligible students who have been registered with APH from their respective states. Nonetheless, article after article has appeared over the past several decades decrying the poor state of Braille literacy amongst the blind. In fact, as Sheffield et al. 22 point out, we don't with any certainty know what percentage of blind people are Braille readers. We also can't prove that any decline from a given point in the past has occurred. Neither can we say that a decline hasn't happened. We can't even say with certainty how many children who should be learning Braille have not been taught Braille, a point to which we shall return later. We simply do not have these answers. If we were so profoundly unaware of such basic metrics concerning print-based literacy in the United States, it would be considered a scandal. High-ranking educational policy officials and literacy experts would be called on the carpet, and the phrase national crisis would be used. With Braille, the response is far more muted. Myth number two, Braille is inefficient for instruction, information access. In addition to the notion that Braille use is declining, another popular notion is that Braille is somehow too inefficient to be truly useful to blind people today. This assertion takes several forms, sometimes all at once. Braille is too slow to read, too inefficient for instruction. Braille is too bulky, heavy, and impractical. Braille is just too expensive to be viable. In 1985, the latter two points might have warranted a second thought. In the late 1990s, I recall lugging around backpacks full of Braille textbook volumes, and in elementary school, I often waited the better part of a school year to receive one or more textbooks. Still, is that the fault of the Braille itself? Not at all. Today, this argument has lost credibility on several fronts. First, Braille books do not always need to be embossed on paper, except maybe for a tactile graphics supplements, and shipped at a total of cost of many thousands of dollars. It is perfectly possible to produce clean electronic Braille files of those same textbooks to be read by the student, whether elementary school or doctoral student, on a refreshable Braille display. The cost of these devices has been dropping as competition increases, and more varieties of display have become available to individual users. Some, like the Zoom Max e-reader from the NLS program, can even be had for free, which still astounds me. So when someone who is thinking of Braille in bound hard copy form argues that Braille is bulky, they miss the truth that many blind school students and employed professionals alike do not consume their Braille this way anymore. Furthermore, a number of scholars have investigated Braille as it is processed by the reader. Harris et al. 2023, for example, took on this old idea that Braille is inefficient for learning, an idea based once again on faulty data or extremely small sample sizes. They found that Braille readers learn new words using Braille just as efficiently as print readers can do so with print. And they also found that Braille readers can even outperform print readers on tasks on phonological decoding and memory recall. Other scholars, see for example Wall Emerson 09, Fisher Bauman Engelbretson 2016, or Engelbretson et al. 2023, have explored how Braille is taught, how it is read, and the biases against Braille, or simply the scholarly silence about it, that appear in the academic research on Braille literacy. Taken together, nothing any of these researchers has ever found suggests that Braille itself is the problem in any way. Finally, Harris et al. 2023 goes so far as to call Braille literacy instruction just what it is, a right, not a luxury or a privilege. If Braille can be just as efficient to the blind user as print is to the sighted user, then, they argue, it is wrong to withhold that instruction based on notions of inconvenience or inefficiency. Harris et al. 2023. One final thought on this point. If one provides Braille instruction to someone at risk of becoming blind and it turns out that the learner in question retains their functional vision, continues reading print functionally and efficiently, and doesn't ultimately need to use Braille, then no harm has been done. That person now has a tool for the toolbox, one they can decide to use or not. However, the converse is disastrous. If the IEP team, for example, withholds Braille instruction because they think that the child or the adolescent or the young adult is likely to keep their eyesight and retain the ability to read print functionally and efficiently, and that turns out to be wrong, which it often does, they have done an immense disservice and caused potential harm that may last a lifetime, because the person will doubtless feel frustrated and incompetent. They have been denied the means of literacy and information access, and those consequences are real. I deal with them almost daily in my professional life as a certified vision rehabilitation therapist, CVRT, as a certified assistive technology instruction specialist for persons with visual impairments, CADIS, and as a certified orientation and mobility specialist, COMS. From misconceptions to real barriers, learning Braille as an adult. The person sitting across from me sounded frustrated. I think Braille would help me when I go back to work, but my counselor says they can't pay for that. I asked what their vocational rehabilitation counselor said was the reason. My counselor said I didn't need Braille for my work since I can use JAWS or a Mac. I responded sympathetically. I knew three things. First, I knew that I was a certified instructor, both professionally and personally equipped to offer this person Braille. Second, I knew that this person was correct, even if all they had was a gut feeling and lacked the words to articulate it. In their belief that Braille could help them when they re-entered the workforce, that it could even help them to achieve that re-entry. The third thing I knew was that despite the indisputability of the first two points, learning Braille for this person wasn't going to happen. Not through me, because the state simply was not going to pay for it. The conversation I just described is a composite of many similar conversations that I, a capable and certified instructor able to teach Braille, and a Braille reader myself, have had a number of times during my career working with adult learners. There are two systems-level barriers that often thwart the Braille learner who tries to start or continue Braille instruction after exiting the education system. One is the shortage of qualified Braille instructors everywhere. The other is the perception widespread within the vocational rehabilitation system that Braille is a luxury add-on, not really necessary, and quite dispensable. Surveying systemic barriers. A glance at the directory of certificate holders from the Academy for Certification of Vision Rehabilitation and Education Professionals, ACVREP, reveals only a few hundred certified vision rehabilitation therapists, CVRTs, across the United States and Canada. In the adult world, the CVRT is the equivalent of a teacher of students with visual impairments. Knowledge of Braille and the ability to teach it is a required skill for a CVRT. As is the case in every instructional area of our field, there aren't enough CVRTs to go around. In fact, there are far fewer CVRTs than orientation and mobility instructors. If there were no other barriers to Braille access among adults, the dearth of qualified instructors would pose a formidable challenge. Its resolution would be made easier, however, if a second, even higher barrier were resolved first. The second and higher barrier is the variability within the VR system itself. While VR services are federally mandated and federally funded to a degree, state services vary radically from state to state. Some states will pay for independent living skills training, some will not. Some will offer training to senior citizens losing their eyesight, to stay-at-home parents with kids who need to learn adaptive skills for managing a home and for child care, or to people who are still trying to figure out what their next career step is. Other state VR services will absolutely not assist a senior who has retired, a stay-at-home parent trying to learn blindness skills, or a newly blind person who, while going through the adjustment to blindness, is struggling to survive and learn who has not settled on an identifiable career goal just yet. As if the variability across states were not enough, what services a person has access to often comes down to the level of the individual counselor. First, VRCs are not guaranteed to have specialized training or certification in blindness. Some do, many do not. In fact, not all counselors in all states even hold the Certified Rehabilitation Counselor, CRC, credential. I have run out of time for this week's Vision News. I hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next week. I'm Doris Hyde, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Vision News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.